Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How truly personal is your taste? We all have our particular likes and dislikes. Yes to cinnamon, no to cloves, that sort of thing. But the broader trends in food that drive us to seek out ever more creative uses for bacon and to suddenly discover we like Greek yogurt better than the kind we grew up with, those turn out to be the product of a complex intersection of culture, agriculture, health concerns, and chef influence. David Sachs joins us to talk about how it all works. He's a writer who specializes in business and food, and his new book is called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. David joins us from the studios of NPR in New York City today. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
If this book taught me anything, it is that my taste is so much more the product of my environment than I like to think it is.
Yeah, I think we all think that what we put into our bodies and our mouths is such an individual thing. As you said, you know, you love cinnamon, but you hate cloves, or my father hates cilantro. That's sort of an obvious thing. But when we all reach for the sriracha sauce or the sriracha chicken sub at Subway, so to speak, we think we're doing it because we've discovered something or because, oh, this is what I like. But there's so many other factors that go into it: cultural factors, social factors, economic factors. And those are food trends. And they really drive increasingly more and more of our collective appetite, so to speak.
And some of them happen slowly, and you have a story in here about cupcakes, and some sort of explode overnight, like the cronut. Can you talk about what determines the speed with which these things move?
Well, I think, you know, food trends are growing and sort of popping up on us quicker and quicker. And that is a product more of the media environment around food and the interconnectedness of, you know, online culture of social networks than anything else. So food trends are nothing new. You know, when the Italians and the Viennese discovered coffee, you know, this bean that was grown in Ethiopia and it brought it over from Africa and started making cafes, and that spread out around the world. I mean, that was a product of hundreds of years. Fast forward to, you know, trends in the 1950s and 60s, the fondue trend. That took, you know, 20 years to go from Swiss-style fondue becoming popular in New York City to, you know, the media picking up on it, and then all of a sudden becoming, you know, the home fondue party of the 1970s with all the Herb Albert records that you could stack as you did that. But, you know, today you can't take a bite anywhere. You can't go to a restaurant. You can't do anything without someone chronicling it. Even at home, we're taking photos of the food we're cooking and posting them up on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter for people to comment on and see. And then it feeds their hunger for these things. Oh, wow, I saw all these pictures of people making kale burgers, or we should make a kale burger. And so the cronut is this perfect, beautiful, slightly absurd and somewhat delicious example of how this is kind of crescendoed in our culture. You know, this went from an item that was unleashed at a bakery last May 10th in New York City. And within a few days, there were huge lineups forming for it. Within, you know, a week, they had trademarked the name. Within a couple of weeks, there were bakeries in Texas and Los Angeles and Toronto who were sort of doing their knockoff cronuts or crodos or dosants or all these different things as the lawyers started sending cease and desist letters. And, you know, it almost finished its cycle 2 months later when the South Korean Dunkin' Donuts chain unveiled their New York pie donut, which was basically a cronut, across, you know, 200 some odd locations in South Korea. So the virality of food trends today is what makes them so fascinating and so powerful.
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems that food has always been a big part of everyone's identity, but now we are deliberately broadcasting that identity to everyone else around us.
Yeah, you know, this would have been an interesting topic for a pretty select group of people maybe 25, 30 years ago. Most Americans ate what they ate, and it was a fairly sort of standard diet, and the trends trickled down to them once in a while. But, you know, the past decade and a half has seen the explosion of foodieism, I guess you want to call it. So now it's not just well-traveled, well-versed people, you know, who are gourmands and can name their European wine by appellation. Everybody watches Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. Everybody knows their favorite barbecue restaurant in Dallas, or can talk about, you know, the place where they get the best Thai food, or who's the coolest restaurant, what's the hippest one now. And so as that culture has become more and more mainstream and less defined by sort of a select amount of knowledge and you know, a tremendous amount of wealth that you need to pursue it like you would have to buy truffles, say, 20 years ago. As everybody becomes a foodie, you know, the competitive nature of eating feeds these trends. And it just becomes a bigger part of our cultural conversation.
This book also made me think about the fact that we have associations with particular foods and consuming them at particular times of day. And there's not necessarily any reason why we think of bacon and orange juice in the morning, or at least we used to. And then, you know, we think of other foods as being consumed late at night. Can you talk about the forces that tell us when we're supposed to eat things?
Well, aside from hunger and what's in the fridge, you know, bacon's a very interesting thing because it shows how trends can be manufactured in a way and sort of coerced by industry. In the 1930s, really sort of during the Depression, sales of bacon went down as people started eating lighter breakfast, rolls and juice or coffee. And the Beechnut Packing Company, which was one of the sort of big pork producers at the time and one of the big bacon makers, they contracted a public relations expert, Edward Bernays, who's sort of known as the father of public relations, a legendary figure in the marketing world. And he conducted a study of a number of doctors. He sort of polled them. Probably paid them too, to say, you know, what's a healthier thing, a hearty breakfast including bacon and eggs, or, you know, juice and a coffee? And, you know, the doctors, again, who were probably all on the kitty, came back and said, oh yeah, you know, nine out of 10 doctors prefer bacon and eggs, and that's a thing. And so that, you know, the media then picked up on it and say, doctors say in groundbreaking study that bacon and eggs is what you should be eating for breakfast, and it becomes ingrained in the culture. So as you don't even think about it, this is what you eat, this is what you should be having. And this happens with food trends, you know, today. You know, the flurry of media attention over antioxidants of the past couple of years, especially with someone like Dr. Oz, a very popular media figure with a huge, huge voice, a real tastemaker in the health and wellness field. You know, you should eat this because it contains antioxidants. You should eat that because it contains antioxidants. You know, raspberries are great for you. Blueberries are great for you. You should have turmeric because it's really high in antioxidants. You should have kale because it's really high in antioxidants. None of us know what antioxidants are. Let's not kid ourselves. I mean, there are people who do. Mm-hmm. The best definition, I think, is essentially it's what gives food its pigment, fruit and vegetables. It's dark. You know, so the darker the fruit, the more antioxidants mm-hmm. it has. And there have been some studies linking potentially some antioxidants to some potential health benefits, but it's not this overwhelming thing like drink water, you're not going to get dehydrated. But, you know, we pick up on these things. We hear about it so much so that we're walking down the supermarket aisle and it says, hey, you know, this Snapple has antioxidants now. It says right there, now with antioxidants. This has to be good for me. I'm going to get it. And so these behaviors are reinforced by food trends. And they just sort of fade into the background. Well, we're not even thinking about them, but everybody has pomegranate juice in their fridge all of a sudden, and you don't even know why.
And the pomegranate story is very interesting because it really was really about creating a desire in the American supermarket going public by people who realized that they could grow a lot of pomegranates.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of food trends, especially in the agricultural world, and especially health and diet trends, which are very confusing trends. They're minefields, I think, because you're playing with people's fears. You know, this eat this and it will you know, essentially prevent cancer, which gives the back message of if you don't eat this, you're going to get cancer. And that's what the folks at Palm Wonderful really did. I mean, they had acquired pomegranate orchards outside of California and in a separate land deal. And the market for pomegranates then, I guess in the early 2000s or late 90s, was really contained to sort of Middle Eastern populations in the California area, you know, the Persian population, the Armenian population. And so they said, well, what can we do with this? How can we get this to sell? Well, what sells is, you know, is stuff backed by studies or science. And so they paid for studies to show the health benefits of pomegranates. They're high in antioxidants. Therefore, they might – studies have shown that antioxidants can prevent certain types of cancer. Therefore, dot, 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 we'll leave the conclusion open to you, and so on. And it got to the point where they pushed the message so hard with advertisements that they had advertisements that said, you know, cheat cancer, and it had the curvy little pomegranate bottle on it, or, you know, we're off to save prostates, or even implying that, you know, it could help with infertility and you know, erectile dysfunction. I mean, really veering into snake oil territory, but that's what sells, right? And as they did that, sales shot up, and of course, other companies started pushing pomegranate products, and other companies started pushing antioxidant products. Oh gosh, you know, the Maine blueberry farmers realize they have antioxidants in their products. Well, all of a sudden, that's super sexy, and they're putting blueberries in everything. And, you know, you go to your local bakery, and they're selling donuts, and it's like, it's a blueberry donut, so it has antioxidants, so it's kind of good for you. But at the end of the day, you know, the science was very, very sort of – circumstantial, let's say, and the Federal Trade Commission clamped down on Palm Wonderful and said, you know, this is blatant false advertising. You cannot say this. I mean, in the European Union, they banned the use of the term superfoods because it's actually a meaningless marketing term that is deceptive, and people attach it to anything. There was a product called 7-Up Antioxidant Berry or Antioxidant Cherry that was out a couple years ago. And again, you know, after a lawsuit, they pulled it off the market because, you know, they dropped a few things a couple of milliliters of fruit juice in a can of 7-Up. And, you know, all of a sudden this is great for you. So food trends have the potential to shape our eating habits in very powerful ways, and none more so than these health and diet trends, you know, which is very different from a cupcake trend. I don't think anyone's eating a cupcake or a cronut and saying, you know, this is going to prevent cancer. It's just going to make you happy.
Well, it makes sense from the perspective of the agriculture industry, particularly those crops that require like an orchard. You know, that's a long-term investment. You better put some marketing muscle behind selling this stuff before you decide that you're going to cast your lot with pomegranates or with clementines or with a certain kind of apple.
Absolutely. And so in the book, I write about a family that has a company in Ontario, near where I live, Ontario, Canada, outside of Toronto, and they grow an apple called the Red Prince. It's a Dutch variety. Their family sort of in the Netherlands grew it, and they moved over in the early 2000s to Canada to cultivate it for the North American market. And they put a tremendous marketing campaign. I think it was about $2 million, which is really, you know, just this family farm. It's not a huge conglomerate. To introduce the Red Prince apple to the Canadian market. And they sent out, you know, dozens of young men dressed in suits and red satin velvet ties and with apples on silk pillows to the Toronto Business District one day to, you know, kneel down and open doors for women and hand out apples to people. They had tremendous amount of press coverage and articles in business magazines and lifestyle magazines about the new apple and how apples are branded. And again, it's just an apple. But when you walk into a supermarket and you see, you know, seven different apple varieties stacked there in a pile, none of them are packaged, how do you choose between them? Well, oh, okay, you know, Red Delicious, I know that. Granny Smith, I know that. Oh, Red Prince, I've heard about that. That sounds interesting. That sounds kind of, you know, fancy, but it's an apple, so it's got to be, you know, really, really delicious. And you know, all that, everything from the logo they picked to the name of it to the color. I mean, it's the same process that they go through when they're selling cars. And so increasingly we're seeing foods, agricultural foods, branded in that way.
We're talking about food trends with David Sachs, whose new book is called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Boot Camp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Sachs, a writer who specializes in business and food and has a new book out called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I was fascinated, David, to think about how important it is that you name a food correctly. And if it's not named correctly, that you rename it to get people to think about trying it.
Yeah, that is it's a funny thing because you would think, well, we like what we like because it tastes a certain way. But as one of the branding experts that I spoke to the book said, you know, we eat with our ears and our eyes first. And so when you hear the name Patagonian toothfish, you just imagine this awful, snarly creature from gosh knows where. Change that name to Chilean sea bass, as a gentleman named Lee Lance did in the 1970s. And all of a sudden, you create one of the hottest fishes in the world, to the point where that fish, which nobody wanted before, is basically fished to the point of extinction. Hmm. And you see the same thing happen sort of over and over. I read about a woman named Frida Kaplan, who in the 1950s heard about these fruits that were in New Zealand and China, and they were called the Chinese gooseberry or the hairy bush fruit. That's my favorite name. and she said, you know, these are interesting and I think I can sell them, but you guys got to work on the name. So they said, well, you know, we grow them in New Zealand. Why don't we call them kiwis? Boom. There we go. The dessert of the 80s, right? Mm. And then the dessert garnish of the 90s. So the names are an incredibly interesting thing. And again, you know, the same thought goes into that. That goes into a consumer good, a shoe or a car or, you know, a condominium complex. You know, what is the product that we have here and what is the promise that we want to deliver to customers? And so if you can deliver that promise with a name like Red Prince Apple, for example, the apple that I read about in the book, then when someone bites in and takes that taste and they say, yeah, this is red. The color is red. And, you know, it gives me all those associations that I thought it would. It's juicy. It's kind of sophisticated. You know, that's great. But if it tastes like, I don't know, a three-day-old steak, then you know, you're going to sort of break that promise.
Interestingly, sometimes it's about technology, too. Like, for example, making bacon something that we want on a sandwich happened after restaurants figured out how to have it available at lunchtime.
Yeah, the bacon trend is really fascinating. You know, now we sort of have seen it at its wonderful, crazy, exuberant height. Bacon ice cream sundaes at Burger King or the Baconalia menu at Denny's or just, you know, interesting restaurants doing everything from bacon and tossed with Brussels sprouts to bacon on fast food sandwiches. So what happened was, you know, bacon was always the staple food, as we talked about. It was bacon and eggs for breakfast. And then there would be the spike of bacon consumption in the summer when tomatoes were in season. And then you would have BLTs, club sandwiches, and Cobb salads. That was sort of the high point of bacon in the summer. Summer of bacon. And then the price of bacon would drop, you know, after Labor Day, basically. You know, you don't wear white and you don't eat bacon after that period of time. What happened was that, you know, the pork belly price market followed that. And then in the 1980s and 1990s, you had the big and very powerful low-fat health crazes, fat phobia. There is scientific research to come out that, you know, saturated fat is really bad for you. You shouldn't be eating any saturated fat, especially, you know, high-fat things like bacon. You know, go home, throw out your bacon, fill your fridge with margarine. And everything that followed from that, all the low-fat bars and shakes and cereals and products, but also, you know, the type of meat we ate totally changed. Everybody was now interested in loins and chops that were really low fat and boneless, skinless chicken breasts. You know, our cursed decade of only consuming boneless, skinless chicken breasts. and bacon took a real hit. And, you know, the price of pork bellies wallowed really low. It was very hard to sell them. And so, you know, after a decade or so of this, the pork producers went to the marketing board, the pork marketing board, which is based in Iowa and is, you know, partly funded by the USDA. And they said, look, you got to help us with all the fatty meat on this pig. I mean, we've done the other white meat thing and we're selling loins and we're selling chops, but, you know, this is the biggest cut on the animal. We're getting killed on it. You got to find a way to sell bacon. And so what they did was they went to the fast food chains and they said, you know, would you be interested in having bacon on your burgers or your sandwiches? And they said, yeah, because we have all these low-fat burgers, you know, ultra-lean low-fat burgers and boneless, skinless chicken breast sandwiches, and they taste like sawdust. You know, there's only so much mayonnaise we can put on them. You got to help us. But we don't want to have to deal with the mess of cooking bacon, which, as anyone who's cooked bacon knows, is you know, you're just left with grease and smoke and you got to wipe down your whole counter and, you know, squeegee off the walls because it just clings to everything. And a fast food chain doesn't want to have to deal with that. So what they did was, with money from the pork marketing board and the various pork producers, they funded research at Iowa State University's at a couple of agricultural colleges to make consistent pre-cooked round bacon. So, you know, they would arrive at a restaurant. You could open up the package, put a little slice of bacon in a sort of convection oven. It would warm up. It would be crisp. It would be warm. It would smoky. It would taste just like bacon because that's what it was. But all the greasy, messy part will have been done elsewhere. And the fast food chains loved it. They could take this, which is, you know, 10 cents, sell it on a burger for an extra $1 or $2. And the sales of those burgers went up tremendously. And so this trend, while most trends sort of tend to trickle down from higher-end innovative restaurants in the foodie world, you know, out through middle restaurants and to the supermarket sort of mass market, eventually ending up at fast food, this was the opposite. It really came from the bottom up. And what happened was, you know, chains like Wendy's and Burger King and Arby's and eventually McDonald's started putting bacon on their sandwiches, and they sold really, really well. And as people started eating more of this bacon, you know, the fat phobic diet really died down at the beginning of the 2000s when, like all these fad diets, research showed that, okay, wait, maybe
we
saturated
wrong.
Fat actually. Yeah, we were wrong. Sorry. Sorry for all those years you had to eat margarine. I'm really sorry. And, you know, even more evidence of this is coming out now. So please enjoy your butter, people, and enjoy your full fat briskets. And then it just kind of took off, and it went from this food service, you know, industry trend into a cultural trend. And then you had chefs putting bacon jam on muffins and bacon into scones and bacon, maple bacon donuts and all these things. And, you know, it created this phenomenon known as bacon mania. And you have bacon festivals now where people will pay hundreds of dollars to fly to Chicago for a day. And for 3 hours, they just pig out. Pun entirely intended. They pig out on as many bacon dishes as they can in this, you know, a convention center. And, you know, there'll be bacon candy floss and bacon vodka and you know, they'll be wearing bacon T-shirts that they made at home. I mean, it's just this amazing thing. So that's what food trends do. They often can move from something that, you know, starts an industry trying to just move some product into something that's a much larger cultural phenomenon and almost is like a internet meme, so to speak.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Scott on the line in Allen. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I'm sorry, I have a sore throat. I was just hoping you could speak to the future of genetically modified foods in the market and how that was going to affect branding foods such as like the red plant stuff we'll be talking about.
That's interesting. You know, I think in North America it's been a different situation than in Europe, where there's a much bigger resistance to it. Although there was that proposition in California 2 years ago to have them labeled, but I think, you know, the rise of organics, the rise of local food, again, which was something that was very much a niche. You know, this is only for the people living in Berkeley, California, and maybe some people in New York. You know, nobody cares about this hippie stuff. Now, all of a sudden, you know, Chipotle is telling you where they're sourcing their pigs from, and McDonald's is bragging about its bona fides and local sourcing. So I think the genetic piece of it will probably come into that as well. As if it can stay in the news long enough, if people in that community are able to make it an issue that your average consumer cares about, then it becomes a sort of political food trend. And it influences the buying decision of those companies which are sort of at the top of the food chain. And they say, well, listen, you know, we could probably sell more hamburgers if we boasted that they were, you know, not genetically modified. Or if people want genetically modified, then you can say that. But it still remains unseen where that's going. And, you know, that movement hasn't taken off as strongly as, say, the organic movement or even the local movement.
David, how did chefs become people who are followed by the paparazzi? And what influence have they had over time on the kinds of things we think we want to eat?
Well, I think I could sum it up in two words, and it's the Food Network. Mm-hmm. You know, when I learned to cook, I was in university in Canada, and it was right when the Food Network came out, and I would just sit there watching Emeril Lagasse for hours on end, and then go and try to replicate his recipes. And, you know, I worship the man.
Bam.
And what it did was it turned chefs into celebrities, as you said. It turned food into entertainment. And as the Food Network sort of grew over its first couple years from the mid-90s to, you know, the early 2000s, that's exactly at the point where this digital food media began. And then you started having all these blogs like Serious Eats and Grub Street and Eater in all these different cities. Every newspaper, even though they were shrinking their news sections, the food section started getting beefed up. Food became our new art and our new culture. And this was something that we talked about. And so the most visible tastemakers at the top of that were chefs. And it just kept growing and growing. You know, Top Chef came out, and all of a sudden you're having 21 newly minted quote-unquote celebrity chefs released into the wild like fawns each season. And I remember when I was living in New York, I would walk around and you would see a sign popping up saying, you know, brand new restaurant featuring Top Chef season 3 contestant, you know, I don't know, Joey Tattoos or whatever his name was, right? And of course, you know, the coverage of this, the attention they all received, made this world very competitive. Suddenly, these chefs were not competing for the review from, you know, the Dallas newspaper or from the New York Times who was coming in. They were competing to stay in that news cycle that was ongoing 24 hours a day, blogs, online, Twitter, you know, all sorts of different shows. And so to do that, they need to create dishes that are going to get attention. So, you know, someone says, look, we cook a really nice steak at our restaurant. It's an amazing steak. It's, you know, grass-fed Texas Longhorn. It's the best steak around. Okay, yeah, that's interesting. We cook a steak that's, you know, simmered in sriracha, and we sous vide it for 14 days in a bath of mussel shells or whatever. I mean, there's almost this arms race of innovation that comes around with these chefs trying to compete for attention. And you know, they're doing it to sell food in the restaurants, but they're also doing it because the more attention they can get, the better deal they can get for a book deal, the better deal they can get for a television deal. You know, they're referring to themselves as brand, and they're doing it unironically. And so this culture of celebrity chefs just keeps growing and growing. And now it's at the point where people can name, you know, the names of the best chefs in the world, even if they've never eaten at their restaurants.
Hmm. How do food trends sort of go beyond their peak and die off? You already mentioned fondue. I was thinking about the fact that no one's having like a dinner party and saying, it'll be a Polynesian feast, my friends. We just, you know, that was cool 40 years ago and we're not doing it now.
Yeah. The tiki concept.
Right,
the
right.
Tiki bar is still alive in some parts of L.A., I think. But I think because, you know, fundamentally food trends and eating and, as you're saying, entertaining is a cultural phenomenon. It's not about eating for sustenance. Nobody's making Mai Tais to sort of live off of, though they probably should. And so, you know, when you're doing that, you want to show your friends, let's say you're having a dinner party, you want to show them that you're current, that you're with things, that you have a certain knowledge. You want to impress them. And so you're going to do that by cooking things that are trendy, or you're going to go out to restaurants that are sort of new and different. Yeah, we have the old standby steakhouse and we like that, but you know, let's try something new. Oh God, you know, we've gone for sushi, so many times in the past couple of years. Let's go for Vietnamese. That's interesting. Let's go for Korean. I just read about that. And I think that's a very North American phenomenon. And I think that's one of the strengths and sort of the benefits of food trends, is that they push us to be more creative. They push us to be more creative and open-minded eaters. And they push chefs and the people in the food business to be more creative and open-minded creators. Chefs can't rest on the laurels. They constantly have to be looking for new ideas, new dishes, new sources of innovation, new flavors that are going to capture us. And so they're going to say, well, you know, people are already eating sriracha, which a couple of years ago was, you know, a hot sauce that you can only really get in Thai and Vietnamese restaurants. Right. And now it's on a sub in Subway. And so they're going to say, okay, well, people are eating sriracha. Maybe they'll like, you know, Tunisian harissa sauce, or maybe they'll like, you know, different Mexican hot sauces. You know, maybe we can get into more complex moles, or maybe we can get into, you know, Korean bean pastes and stuff. And so it keeps pushing our taste forward and more open. And as a consequence of that, you know, sometimes things get left behind. But generally, the good stuff sticks. So think about, you know, the great trend of olive oil. Here we go back to the 80s and the fat scare. You know, as we were coming out of that fat scare, all of a sudden we realized, well, there was that time where there's good fats and there's bad fats. And the great fat was extra virgin olive oil, right? And there was just this point in time, sort of in the mid-90s, where I recall extra virgin olive oil, there was nothing you couldn't put it on that wouldn't be good. You would throw it into muffins. Now with extra virgin olive oil, you would put them into pancakes, which I recall was a terrible idea taste-wise. Every salad had to have it. Every cracker had to have it. Every bread had to have it. And, you know, we're not so wild over extra virgin olive oil anymore. We still eat a lot of it. I can't remember the last time I made a salad and it didn't work with extra virgin olive oil. That's just my go-to oil for salad. But we don't talk about it as much. It doesn't get the attention that it once does. It just gets absorbed into our diet. And so the good trends, you know, that's what will happen. The fads will kind of come and go for a couple seasons, and maybe we won't be talking about cronuts in a couple years. But, you know, the good stuff sticks.
David Sachs is with us. He's a writer who specializes in business and food. His new book is called The Tastemakers: Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. We'll talk about the rise of the cupcake after we come back. And you can also join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer David Sachs, author of the new book, The Tastemakers: Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, David, as you write in the book, and as I think most of us experienced as children, cupcakes used to be food for children, right? Your mom would make some for your birthday, and maybe if you were lucky, you had friends who had a birthday, and so you got them maybe 10 times a year. And they were really like, they were unquestionably kid food until they became sexy adult food.
Yes. Having just had my daughter's 1-year birthday last week, where we made cupcakes, and we're bringing it back. We're bringing it back to the kids. But I did stuff my face with a couple of them. So, you know, what happened was the story of the great cupcake mania of America and the world is that, you know, in this bakery opened up in New York in the late 90s called Magnolia Bakery. And it was sort of geared to be a kind of traditional Southern bakery. And they made a number of things. And one day they were making someone requested a birthday cake. They'd never made that type of thing before. So they made a birthday cake and they had two different pan sizes and they had some leftover batter. So they ran across the street to get some paper cups at the little bodega and they put it into a muffin tin and they just made cupcakes kind of on a whim as let's not waste this batter.
Mm-hmm.
And people really liked them. They said, oh, yeah, these are good. And suddenly the orders just started increasing and it became this local phenomenon in the West Village in New York. And you know, there was this bit of a New York buzz around cupcakes, but it wasn't anything huge. And then in 2000, they filmed, I think, season two of Sex and the City. One episode, there's one 20-second scene where Carrie and Miranda are sitting in front of Magnolia Bakery, and they eat cupcakes as they're talking about someone that Carrie's dating. That was it. That was the 20-second scene. It wasn't like, you know, every other episode of Sex and the City where they were meeting for Cosmos and brunch and or other episodes which was dedicated to, you know, a certain brand of vibrator that, you know, was part of a plot line. It was a cameo. It was the beat of a buttercream wing, so to speak, that kicked off this hurricane. But what happened was it created this phenomenon. The press started talking about cupcakes and covering it, and not just the food press, but, you know, Vogue magazine and Cosmo, and saying, you know, this is the treat that Miranda likes to eat, and it associated cupcakes with this show, which was all about wealth, women, sexuality, you know, the trappings of wonderful single life of people and the beautiful people in New York City. And, you know, the other symbols of that show were, you know, very expensive dresses and $600 pairs of Jimmy Choo shoes. And yet the cupcake was this thing that anybody could make and anybody could replicate. And even if you went to the Magnolia Bakery, you know, it was a couple bucks to buy one. I mean, it was more expensive than your basic cupcake that you can get at a supermarket, but it was better.
Mm-hmm.
Undoubtedly, it tasted better. And, you know, they were in these beautiful colored frostings and it just took off. And it sort of worked through this media cycle where the media could take the cupcake and they could reinvent it in any way they wanted to. You could do, you know, the fancy Sex and the City cupcake. You could start decorating with different characters and colors on them. You could make them kind of really frilly. You could make them kind of manly cupcakes that had booze in them or, you know, a pigskin. So you could do a Super Bowl-themed cupcake. And it just perpetuated itself until it became this very cultural thing. I remember a couple of years ago that I was in Toronto going to a mall and I walked by a shoe store and they were selling shoes and around this sort of tiered display of high heels were little plastic cupcakes. Like you know, this is so strong an association. It's like, yes, I believe a cupcake will be a good association for me to buy a pair of shoes. Like these will be comfortable shoes because they're next to a cupcake. But what happened is it just kept growing. And it was the first I call viral food trend or 21st century food trend where, you know, the cupcake trend grew as blogs started growing, as Facebook was introduced, as Twitter was introduced, as Instagram came on board. And all of a sudden, you know, it wasn't just food media writing about it. It was everybody sharing their stories of cupcakes, sharing recipes of cupcakes was a huge thing. You could do it anywhere. The ingredients were available in any supermarket anywhere you were. And it just grew to this tremendous point where then it went international and cupcakes became this symbol of American comfort and wonder. And, you know, now you have cupcake shops in Asuncion, Paraguay, where there's two cupcake shops. You have cupcake shops in Lahore, Pakistan, in Rwanda, in all the Gulf states where, you know, of course, in Dubai, they have a $2,000 cupcake with gold leaf on it. You can eat with a gold spoon. I guess, you know, if you're taking the emir out to lunch or something or his kid out for their birthday. And you know, again, it was almost not about cupcakes. It was about, here is something that we can just take and do anything we want. It's tabula rasa. It's this blank canvas. And that's that, you know, really define the era of food trends that we're looking in or that we're living in. And yet fundamentally, at the end of the day, the appeal of that cupcake is the same as when you were a kid, Chris. It's, you know, this is a little cake and I could, you know, eat it in three bites.
So help me understand this. I know people, and we're a little bit late to the game here in North Texas, but we are full on into the food truck trend, right? Like, how did we become convinced that just because a hot dish is served through a cutout in a converted Airstream trailer that it's going to taste better than anything we have ever had anywhere else?
Well, I think there is that element of novelty to it when it first comes around to different cities. And so, you know, you saw that when food trucks started rolling out in all these different cities. You know, initially, oh, wow, they're making a grilled cheese here. That's great. But I think, you know, food trucks are interesting because fundamentally what they are is just a new innovative business model. The fact is, you know, you're not taking your date out for dinner there. You're not going for your anniversary to a food truck. You generally go at lunchtime from work or school because you don't want to have to go sit down at a restaurant and, you know, wait for the waiter to come to your table and what do you want and so forth and so on and the bill that goes along with that. You just want to grab something and go. But, you know, in terms of the taste factor, the interesting thing about food trucks is that they seem to push innovation more than other restaurants do because the barrier of entry is lower, because it costs less to own and operate a food truck than a restaurant, and because they have to fight for the attention of people who are walking by regular restaurants or people who they have to capture in the span of 1 hour before lunch is over and, you know, they have to move on from their parking spot, they're taking more greater risks. And so you get people saying, well, you know what, we got this food truck, let's see what we can do. Why don't we do, you know, grilled cheese and pulled pork together? Why don't we do barbecue, but we're going to do kind of Texas and Mexican style barbecue in one sandwich, and we're going to deep fry it and put it on a stick and, you know, ice it and call it a, I don't know, sort of a brisket heaven cupcake. So, you know, there, once you get past that initial kind of wow factor of, wow, we have food trucks, we should try them. You know, these scenes are highly competitive, and it's a highly competitive economy where a lot of food trends get born because people really need to get attention. You know, they don't have fixed locations. They can't get you with their wine menu. They can't get you with, you know, how great the servers are, the music. You're judging that purely on taste. And because of that, they're really trying to innovate as much as possible, and they're pushing to create the next food trend.
How do all these trends filter down to what we find in the supermarket when we intend to cook for ourselves?
Well, it's a process that happens sort of deliberately through the industry. There are sort of the big companies that are selling things in the supermarkets and the supermarkets. And then there are companies and sort of firms and consultants that they pay to watch and monitor and forecast food trends, almost like Wall Street analysts, and say, okay, what's coming down the pipes, or what can we take that's in the kind of hip culinary world? What's going on in the food trucks and the cool restaurants? And what's going to be accessible and appeal more to the mass market? Is it going to be something like, you know, sous vide, cooking meat in bags for a set period of time to get it right, and, you know, modernist foam? Well, no, we don't think the average, you know, person in North Dallas or Dallas is going to be interested in that. But, you know, this sriracha thing, I mean, this Thai hot sauce, you know, we have a long tradition of hot sauces here in Texas. You know, people like spicy food here. Maybe we could integrate that some way. I don't know. You know, it doesn't have to be a Thai dish. Maybe we can try it on a brisket. Maybe we could try it on a sub. Maybe we could try it with chicken. And so then they'll go back to their test kitchens and they'll, you know, sample it and bring in groups and sort of do their data calculations and use all sorts of data, from immigration data to demographic data to economic data, to say, okay, we think this is going to work, and now we're going to roll it out into, you know, the Subway Sriracha Chicken Melt Sub. And so it's a very deliberate process that brings that to the market, or, you know, turns those things into a flavor of Doritos or a flavor of 7-Up. And not every trend makes it that far. But when it does, you know that that's, you know, a trend that's probably going to last for a while.
And are, I mean, is, does everything hit a cycle? You mentioned coffee, and even coffee, although it's been with us since, you know, Europeans discovered how awesome it was, it hasn't, it really does sort of come in waves, doesn't it?
Exactly. So even within a certain food, you know, you have trends. Coffee's the perfect example, right? It's our morning staple. It's something we always have, and yet every decade we're drinking it differently, right? You know, our parents were drinking instant coffee. Then there was sort of French press. Then there was the first kind of cappuccino moment, which was the really tall, foamy cappuccinos where you always had to dust cinnamon on top, always. Mm-hmm. Without cinnamon on top, it wasn't a proper cappuccino. And then, of course, came the Starbucks latte revolution. And then, you know, it got turned into these coffee milkshakes, the frappuccinos and various, I call them diabetes delivery systems. How can we take this cup of coffee and turn
it
into a milkshake?
Make it worse for you, right.
Yeah, exactly. Make it, give me some caramel. Could you top my coffee off with some caramel and two scoops of whipped cream? And then, you know, it's this pendulum swings back to, okay, now these other businesses are trying to get back to the roots. So you have what they call the third wave coffee bars, which are places where, you know, they're real, earnest, super dedicated baristas. Don't call them coffee shop workers, God forbid. you know, who are extracting the single origin fair trade beans from this specific region of Guatemala, and they cook it in a beaker that has a vacuum in it, and so on and so forth. And it just keeps going around and around and around. And I think that speaks to the fundamental American nature of food trends, which is that, you know, we're a culture that is extremely innovative. We like to invent. We like to do new things. We like to create. And with food, you know, we're very open to it. I think a lot of other cultures aren't. In Italy, you know, the idea of a frappuccino is blasphemous. You know, they like their espresso exactly the certain way, and you never have a cappuccino after the morning. You know, you never do that. And here we're saying, what's next? What's new? What's interesting? Someone's saying, hey, I'm going to start a new business that's going to be a whole new type of coffee shop, and we're going to cook it with, I don't know, steam power that we make on bicycles, or who knows what's next, right? It's going to be wood-fired beans. That's the way we're going to do it, to get the original Ethiopian flavor. That's the wonderful thing about food trends, I think, and why, you know, I've certainly come around to them, that despite all the crazy, you know, cupcake bouncy castles that you might see in this world, they represent this spirit of innovation and the spirit of openness around both business and our own edible culture. And the more we have them, the more that culture gets pushed forward, and the better food we have to eat and drink.
Okay, give me your prediction for the staying power of gluten-free for people who do not have a medical sensitivity to gluten. I don't want to discount the individuals that really can't eat it.
No. So all you people who are celiac or have, you know, a serious problem digesting gluten or wheat products, this following statement does not count for you. But for the rest of the people who have no idea what gluten is and just sort of heard it's something healthy to eat or that Gwyneth Paltrow was avoiding, you know, it probably is not long for this world. It seems to be a fad diet, and you know, there has been evidence out in the past couple of weeks from the very doctor that you know, initially discovered gluten intolerance, that said, well, I went back and checked my research, and it turns out, you know, there is no such thing as gluten intolerance. There may be intolerance to certain types of wheat, but, you know, there's now a multi-billion-dollar economy of gluten-free products, and I think a lot of those might be endangered because of this. And, you know, it's unrealistic to imagine that people are going to eat in this certain very restrictive way. But it's a market, and where people in the food business see opportunity, they'll go chasing it, whether it's gluten-free or antioxidants or low-fat or cupcakes.
David Sachs is a writer who specializes in business and food. His new book is called The Tastemakers: Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure as well.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, but she actually produced today's show with help on the phones from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.